Hello everyone, I'd like to welcome you to our 2013 Legal Issues webinar series. My name is Jessica Madrigal and I will be moderating your session today. We just want to take a few moments and go through some logistics of using our webinar platform. We realize that we have some new users and some veterans, so just want to make sure that everyone is on the same page and understands how to work all of our features. The audio for today's session is being broadcast through your computer, so please make sure that your speakers are turned on or your headphones are plugged in, whatever your preference. You can control your audio via the audio and video panel. It is the panel right on the top left of your screen. You can adjust the sound by sliding the sound bar left or right to make it less loud or more loud. If you're having an issue with the sound quality, you can check your audio controls by going through our audio setup wizard, which you can access by selecting the microphone icon on the audio and video panel, and that will allow you to configure your speakers and your sound to make that a little bit better for you. If you don't have sound capabilities on your computer, or if your preference is to listen by phone, we do have phone access today. Please note that it is not a toll-free number, but if you prefer, you can call into 1-712-432-3066 and you can use passcode 148937 to access the audio via telephone. We do have a new feature for mobile users. Right now it exists for iPhone and iPad users only, but you may listen to the session using the Blackboard Collaborate app, which is available free from the Apple Store for iPhones and iPads. If you need the direct link to the session in order to use the app, you can call us at 877-232-1990 and we would be happy to assist you with that. Please note that closed captioning is not visible via the mobile app. Speaking of captioning, we do provide real-time captioning during our webinars. The caption screen can be accessed by choosing the CC icon that is in the top right of the audio and video panel. Once you've selected that icon, it will open the captioning window, and from there you can change the font size, change the size of the window, move it around, and then also save the transcript if you wish to do that. As with many of the webinars that we do in the Legal Webinar Series, we always get questions from our participants. We have a few ways for you to submit your questions to us. You can type and submit your questions in the chat area text box, or just press Control M and enter your text into the chat area. If you're using the mobile app on your mobile device, you can submit questions in the chat area within the app. And if you're listening by phone and not logged into the webinar platform, you can email us at webinars@ada-audio.org and we would be happy to pass your questions on to today's presenters. Just a note, we do record all of the webinars in our series, and that will be able to be accessed by you at our website, www.ada-audio.org, in about 24 hours after the conclusion of the session. You can customize your view of the webinar room. You can resize the whiteboard where you are seeing the presentation slides to either make it smaller or larger by choosing from the drop-down menu located above and to the left of the whiteboard. The default setting is to fit the page, so if you would like to make that larger or smaller, now would be a good time to do that. You can also reposition and resize the chat, participant, and audio and video panels by detaching them and using your mouse to stretch and shrink them to your liking. You can do that by using the icon in the top right of each panel. It looks like four or five lines stacked on top of each other, and those will allow you to move those around. Last but not least, if you're experiencing any kind of technical difficulty during the webinar, we are here to support you and make this as enjoyable of an experience as we can. So you can send a private chat message to me by double-clicking Great Lakes ADA in the participant list. That will open up a new tab where you can type your comment and press Enter or keyboard F6, arrow up or down to locate Great Lakes ADA, and then select to send a message. I will be monitoring those private chats and be able to assist you with your technical difficulties. You can also email us with your technical difficulties at webinars@ada-audio.org. Or you can call us at 877-232-1990, and we would be happy to troubleshoot for you over the telephone. So without further ado, I am going to pass this over to Barry Taylor and Rachel Weisberg, who are going to be presenting our session today.
Great. Thanks, Jessica. And hi, everybody. This is Barry Taylor, and I'm joined by Rachel Weisberg from Equip for Equality for today's session. And for those of you who aren't familiar with Equip for Equality, we are the protection advocacy system for people with disabilities in Illinois and provide free legal advocacy services. If you are not aware of the protection advocacy agency in your state, you can go to our National Association's website, ndrn.org, to locate the PNA in your state. Also, just wanted to let people know that today, if you're an Illinois attorney, this session is eligible for 1.5 hours of continuing legal education credit. All you need to do is, at the end of the session, once it's completed, send me an email at barryt@equipforequality.org, and we will follow up with you with your certificate. We'll also be sending you an evaluation that we need to continue as a continuing legal education provider. That is an evaluation in addition to the one that Great Lakes will send you, so we appreciate if you'll fill out both of those, and we'll show the slide again at the end of the session. So today what we're going to be doing is going through this PowerPoint, and my understanding is that the PowerPoint and a legal brief that provides much more detailed analysis has been made available to you at the ada-audio.org website. If you haven't gotten it already, you can get that after the session and download those two materials for your future use, and feel free to forward those on to others who may be of interest here. And what we're going to be doing today is focusing on two aspects of the hospitality industry and its interface with the ADA. One is we're going to be looking at how it interplays with Title III of the ADA, public accommodations, and we'll be focusing mostly on hotels, restaurants, and cruise lines. And once we do that, then we'll be focusing on the employment provisions, people with disabilities who work within those industries who may have potential ADA claims. So the specific title, three issues we're going to be focusing on are numerous. I'm going to do the first one, which is legal standing, and then I'm going to turn it over to Rachel, and she's going to focus on statute of limitations, and then look at the 2010 standards for accessible guest rooms, places of lodging, as well as accessible pools. And then she'll move on to barrier removal in the hospitality industry. We'll take a quick break at that point to see if you have any questions on those topics. And then we'll resume with me looking at service animals and reservation policies under Title III. And then I'll turn it back over to Rachel to look at communication access and website access. We'll take another break to see if there are any questions on those issues, and then we'll move on to the Title I issues in employment that we'll get to in a little bit. So I'm sure most of you on the webinar know that Title III prohibits discrimination by places of public accommodations, that's private businesses open to the public. And you'll remember that under the ADA, you have to show that you fit within the public accommodation at issue fits within one of the 12 enumerated categories within the text of the ADA. And this has not been a difficult issue within the hospitality industry to prove that issue, because hotels, motels, inns, and restaurants are specifically listed right in the ADA, within the 12 categories. So that's not been an issue of litigation. And just remember that there's a 15-person requirement to be covered under Title I of the ADA for employment purposes, but there's no such employee number requirement for Title III. So a small restaurant could have insufficient employees to be covered under Title I for employment, but they still could be covered under Title III. And we also have a link here to a previous legal brief that we did, Alan Goldstein and I, regarding hot topics in Title III litigation. So if you're interested in other Title III issues that we don't cover today, you should check out that brief and see if that's something that might be of use, as well as all the other legal briefs that we've done in the past over the years. We wanted to alert you to a case that just settled within the last few weeks. That deals with the ADA and the hospitality industry. It's a case that was brought by the Department of Justice against Corral of Westland. And this was a case that was brought after a woman went into a restaurant with her four children, and three of them had a genetic disease that caused severe blistering. And apparently the manager was alarmed when he saw the blisters on the children and went to question the mother about whether it was safe for the children to be in the restaurant. And the mother assured the restaurant manager that the children's disease was not contagious. Despite her assurance, the manager denied service to the family, and he said that he needed them to leave because the children's presence made other customers uncomfortable. And the manager actually called the police when the children's father came later to question the manager's actions. Ultimately, then, the Department of Justice filed suit against the Corral of Westland, and we just found out that on April 15th, just a few weeks ago, DOJ has reached an agreement with the Corral of Westland to resolve this case. If you go to the DOJ's website, ada.gov, you'll see a link to the complaint that was filed. As of today, the actual settlement agreement has not been posted on DOJ's ADA website, but we're sure that it'll be up soon. But if you look at the complaint, you can see what was requested and sought by DOJ, and since they settled, I think it's reasonable to presume that that's what they were able to get agreement from. So they wanted to get a declaratory judgment of discrimination. They wanted to get an agreement to prohibit future discrimination. Also wanted the restaurant to establish written policies for accommodating people with disabilities. They asked for training as well as civil penalties and a monetary award. So that's something I'm sure that we'll be getting alert from DOJ soon about the underlying settlement agreement. Let's move on to one of the biggest issues under Title III litigation with respect to the hospitality industry, and that's legal standing. And that may sound like a real dry issue, but it really is something that comes up in many of these cases and is important to understand. Basically, under the law, you have to have standing to bring a lawsuit, meaning you have to have a recognized interest in bringing a suit. And if you don't have standing, you never get to the underlying claim of discrimination. It's sort of like if you can't prove you have an ADA disability, whether you're discriminated against becomes irrelevant because you can't move forward. And it's the same thing with standing. You can't move forward until you're deemed to have standing to bring your lawsuit. And the Supreme Court has recognized that to have standing, you have to show that you've suffered some sort of personalized and concrete injury in fact of a legal interest, that your injury is traceable to the defendant's conduct, and that it must be likely, as opposed to speculative, that a favorable court decision will redress your injury. And as I mentioned, many of these Title III cases rise and fall on the question of standing. And one of the main components of these standing cases is that plaintiffs have to show that there will be some sort of harm or future injury due to the ADA violations. And one reason you have to focus on the future injury or harm if the ADA violations aren't remedied is that Title III does not provide monetary relief. It only provides prospective injunctive relief, changes to the issue or addressing the barriers that are there. And so you have to show that if those barriers aren't removed, you will be injured in the future, and therefore you're entitled to bring suit, that it's not just a past injury, but you're subject to potential injury in the future. You also have to show that there's a relationship of the alleged discrimination to your disability, and then we'll also talk a little bit about some of the issues regarding frivolous lawsuits and how that interplays with standing. But the main issue that comes up in these cases is harm or future injury. And what courts have done is they've focused on four factors. One is the proximity of the business to the plaintiff's home, meaning is it close to you, is it a place you're going to go back to? And some courts have said that that's less important in the cases involving hotels with respect to proximity. The other three factors are the plaintiff's past patronage of the business. This is a place they've been regularly in the past. The definitiveness of the plaintiff's plans to return to that business, and the plaintiff's frequency of travel near that particular business. So those are four factors courts will look at in analyzing these cases. So let's move on to some of the actual cases. The first case we have is Campbell versus Moon Palace. And this is a restaurant case in Florida. And in this case, the plaintiff had arthritis and used a wheelchair. And he found a number of accessibility violations, I think a total of 37 within the restaurant, that went from doors to entrances to inaccessible bar, cashier desk, aisles, restrooms, seating, and parking. And the court found that he did not have legal standing because he did not testify that he intended to visit the restaurant in the future and actually talked about preferring other similar restaurants. And he did say he would probably, you know, end up going back someday, and the court said that was just too speculative and not definitive enough, and therefore they found in favor of the plaintiff, of the defendant, and found that the plaintiff had no standing. The next case you'll see is rather familiar. It's the same case name, Campbell versus Moon Palace. What happened was, after the plaintiff lost, the lawyer said, wait a second, we got to try this again, and they filed a new a motion for reconsideration. And the plaintiff provided more information trying to address this standing problem and put forth sworn testimony, an affidavit, saying, I will 100% absolutely visit this facility again. He said he was going to go there to celebrate the anniversary with his girlfriend, and he had done other ADA cases, and he says, I always return to the place that I sued after my attorney lets me know the facility is in compliance with the ADA. And lo and behold, the strategy by the lawyer worked, and the court found that the threat of future discrimination this time was real and immediate, and found that the customer did have standing to bring his claim, and so the case could move forward. Just a quick little tip for those of you who might be thinking about bringing these kind of cases in the future, either as a plaintiff or as an attorney, is, you know, get it all in there the first time. The fact that this court agreed to a motion to reconsider, granted that motion, while good for the plaintiff here, is typically very difficult standard. So the tip here is to get all the definitiveness information, the future harm and injury information, into your original complaint, and don't wait till the court questions your standing. We'll move on to another case. The next one is National Alliance for Accessibility versus Triad Hospitality Corporation. And this was a plaintiff who had cerebral palsy, was paralyzed from the waist down. Is a resident of Florida and was visiting North Carolina for a conference. And she identified about 29 different ADA violations in the hotel, restaurants, pools, parking, guest rooms, that type of thing. And the court found here that she lacked standing because she lived far from the hotel, that she had no family or business ties to the area where the hotel was located, and she provided no definitive plans to return. And she had made general statements that she frequently travels to North Carolina, that she liked the Quality Inn, that it was near a NASCAR museum that she thought was really great and wanted to visit it. What was problematic, though, was some of the statements she made turned out to be false. It turned out that the Quality Inn wasn't very close to the NASCAR Museum. I think it was 44 miles away, and it seemed to hurt her credibility. And also, the court seemed to be concerned about the fact that she had had a history of filing ADA suits. She'd filed over 170 ADA suits before this one. And while the court didn't base its decision on that, it certainly deemed that as something that was not a positive. And we'll talk a little bit more about people who bring multiple suits and how that can affect cases in a couple slides. But compare that case with the next one, DeLille versus Best W. Encina Lodge and Suites. And this was a case where the hotel guest had paraplegia and encountered numerous barriers at the hotel. But here the hotel guest established her intent to return to the geographical area. She talked about that she returned to this area 1 to 3 times a year, and that she really liked this particular hotel because it met her needs with respect to taste, style, price and location. And the court said that she did have standing in this case. Ultimately, the court found that. The lower court questioned whether the person had standing and had dismissed the case and, again, looked at the fact that she had filed 60 prior ADA suits. But here, the appellate court didn't find that to be a problem and found that she did provide enough information to show that she had standing to proceed with her case, and also rejected expressly the district court's adverse credibility finding based on the fact that she had brought prior ADA litigation. Not all courts require plaintiffs to establish an intent to return on a specific date, as long as they can show that they express a desire to return generally. And we've got a couple of examples of that. The first one is the Siegel case out of Florida. And in that case, the plaintiff had cerebral palsy and sometimes used a wheelchair for mobility and encountered a number of accessibility barriers. He's another person who brought numerous suits. I think he brought 23 other ADA suits before this one. And the court found that he did have standing to sue the restaurant for accessibility, even though he testified that he only went to restaurants generally 6 times a year and couldn't say exactly when he planned to return to this particular restaurant. Because he expressed a desire to return to the restaurant and he lived only a mile away from the restaurant, that was enough. And here the court also brought up an important issue, and because the defendant said, well, you know, he hasn't tried to come back or said he's going to be coming back in a particular time. And the court said, you know, plaintiffs aren't required to make a futile attempt to return as long as the barriers remain in place. And this is a provision coming out of the ADA that people don't have to make futile attempts when they know the barriers still exist, and that shouldn't defeat standing. So the court brought that important aspect out. And similarly, in the Spector case, this involved cruise lines. You might remember the Spector case. It's one that actually went up all the way to the Supreme Court on whether the ADA applied to foreign flagged cruise ships. Well, after the Supreme Court decided that, they sent it back down to the trial court for the case to go forward, and the issue of whether they had standing came up. And here the court said the cruise line passengers did have standing to bring forth their case. Even though they didn't have definitive plans to take another cruise, the court said the fact that they had taken other cruises in the past, had expressed a desire to return, and were avid travelers, that was enough. And again, the court quoted the futile gesture language favorably in that particular case. Some courts have found that plaintiffs have standing to sue certain hotel and restaurant locations, but not others. This comes up when you have facilities that have multiple locations or chain hotels or chain restaurants. We've got a couple of examples here. The Share case is a recent case out of the Seventh Circuit here in Chicago, and in that case, the court found, just give you a little bit of background. This was a case where a woman went into a Marriott hotel, and the bathroom door had a spring-hinged self-closing mechanism, and the door actually hit the plaintiff and knocked her over, and she broke her wrist and injured her hip. And she filed a personal injury case and tried to add an ADA count, but it wasn't allowed, so she filed a separate ADA case later. And the court found that she did have standing to sue the specific hotel where she had experienced the ADA violation, but she could not sue the other 56 Marriott hotels, even though they used the same door spring in question, because it had not been a specific injury to her. And they said the guest stayed at that specific hotel various times in the past. It was near her relatives, and she expressed a desire to be in there in the future. So she established standing with respect to that specific hotel that she attended and where she had received the injury, but she did not have standing for the others because she failed to show a similar intent to visit any of the other hotels. And similar result in the Access for All case against Starbucks, again, a case out of Florida. In this case, you had multiple plaintiffs, and they raised ADA violations about some specific Starbucks locations they had visited in Florida, and then they listed about 300 additional Starbucks locations that had similar violations that they had found in the ones that they had visited. And the court here, similar to what we saw in Share, found that the plaintiffs only had standing to sue the locations where at least one of the plaintiffs had actually visited the Starbucks and had concrete plans to return to that particular Starbucks. And again, they looked at the proximity from the store to the plaintiff's residence or the planned travel as factors in determining whether they had standing. So if you're looking to challenge beyond those you actually visited, I think probably logistically the only way you're going to be able to do that would be maybe through class actions as opposed to just suing on behalf of one plaintiff or several plaintiffs. Most courts allow plaintiffs to challenge alleged violations that are only related to their disability. So for example, if a person with a mobility impairment experiences violations of ADA in a hotel or a restaurant, they typically can't challenge issues that are unrelated to their disability. So a person with mobility impairment could challenge, you know, inaccessible doors and inaccessible rooms and those types of things, but if there's maybe communication barriers that exist that don't relate to their disability, courts generally have said they are not able to do that. So if you want to bring a case like that, you need to have multiple plaintiffs with different disabilities to address all the different issues involved. A sort of related issue is brought out in Strong, and that is, can you challenge those barriers, even those barriers that you don't personally experience, if they're related to your disability? So in Strong, you had a person with a mobility impairment, and they said he could seek recovery for the barriers related to his mobility disability, even the ones he did not personally observe. If he maybe would learn about it later, maybe through the discovery process, that was enough. And the rationale behind that was, let's say you had an inaccessible entry and you weren't able to get in and you wanted to file suit, and you learned either through other information people gave you or through the discovery process that they had an inaccessible restroom. Even though you didn't personally experience that inaccessible restroom, the reason you couldn't experience it was because you couldn't get to it. And so you should be allowed to address those because they do relate to your disability. And if the previous barrier hadn't been in place, you would have experienced that barrier. It wasn't your fault you couldn't experience that barrier. And so this court said, yes, you can address in your lawsuit barriers that you don't personally experience. But other courts have said plaintiffs can only challenge those accessibility violations experienced personally. So you have a split in the courts here. And here are a couple examples. The Campbell case that we talked about before, as I mentioned, he had identified 37 accessibility violations, but when he was deposed, he actually said he only personally was impacted by 5 violations, and the other 32 that he had identified, like the inaccessible soap dispenser, he admitted in his deposition, he actually never used a soap dispenser. So he couldn't challenge that. He could only challenge those he could prove that he had personally experienced. And similarly, in the Access for the Disabled versus First Resort case, that was a hotel case, and here she had identified numerous barriers, but under deposition indicated that she had not actually personally experienced some of them, like the roll-in shower or the inaccessible towel rack, because she didn't attempt to use those during her stay. What had happened is she walked in, identified all these barriers, and then left saying, I can't stay here. So she didn't actually try the shower. She didn't actually shower, and so she couldn't challenge those. Even though she had seen those, she hadn't actually been impacted by them, which may seem like splitting hairs, but that's where the court came down. And this is another case where the court seemed to be influenced by the fact that this was a person who she was traveling with an ADA expert, and that, you know, perhaps she was just trying to do this for testing purposes and not to actually experience the hotel on her own. There were also some facts that didn't check out. She had alleged that she picked this hotel because it was near the beaches and shopping, and it turned out it wasn't true, and she said she visited it once a month, and actually she hadn't been there, that area, in several years. So I think the combination of sort of her looking to try to do a gotcha with this hotel, and also the fact that some of her facts didn't play out to be true, undercut her claim here. And this kind of leads into the next issue that we wanted to talk about, and that is the standing to regarding frivolous lawsuits. Those of you who have been dealing with the ADA for a while will know that there's been quite a backlash against the ADA, because there have been some plaintiffs out there and attorneys, and I think this is a very minor group of people, but there are some that have filed Title III cases, not to really increase the access or eliminate barriers, but really for financial gain. And many of those cases have been brought by the hospitality industry. There's a case that we've talked about in a previous webinar, the Molsky case, where the plaintiff was deemed to really, you know, be bringing such vexatious litigation and only seeking monetary gain, that the court actually ordered that the plaintiff had to ask permission before filing a lawsuit, which is a highly unusual decision by a judge. And you might remember, too, that the Congress has even looked at passing a law called the ADA Notification Act, which would require you to give notice to Title III entities like hotels and restaurants before filing an ADA claim under Title III. And those efforts have been unsuccessful in Congress. But it's what's happened is some of these bad cases that have come out have painted a broad brush to taint all sort of proactive ADA access efforts. And we even have such terrible terminology like drive-by lawsuits, which sort of equate, you know, people filing lawsuits under the ADA with you know, drive-by shootings, which just is very, very offensive. And, you know, the fact that somebody is testing to advance the civil rights of people with disabilities really is a time-honored tradition. We've had testing done in all kinds of protected classes over the years, and the fact that people do testing should not be really deemed negatively against them, as long as what they're doing is trying to review ways to eliminate barriers as opposed to seek financial gain only. And so some courts have applied the standing analysis to prevent plaintiffs from filing these frivolous lawsuits, although we do have a couple of cases here where the courts did not agree that the fact that the person had filed these previous lawsuits was enough to prevent them from getting standing. The Siegel case we talked about previously, the court said the customer's not stripped of standing just because of the number of lawsuits he's filed. The court has some really good language here and says the ADA, to yield its promise to equal access, it may indeed be necessary and desirable for committed individuals to bring serial litigation, advancing the time when public accommodations will be compliant with the ADA. And the little case is the same type of message and saying that the past history of litigation under the ADA can't be used to question the sincerity to return to the hotel and find that they had no standing. Although those two cases have been positive about people who filed past ADA lawsuits, there was one case that got some really extensive press in 2013 that went the other way and had pretty some extreme facts. And I guess I want to stress that this case is definitely not typical, but it definitely is an inappropriate use, apparently, of the ADA. This was a case where they sued Subway, and after the court had found that Subway was inaccessible, the plaintiff brought a suit, brought a claim for attorney's fees recovery. And the court found that they were not entitled to attorney's fees. The attorney did little besides drafting boilerplate pleadings, and the pleadings they did file were ones that previous courts had admonished them for having incorrect case citations, and that the hourly rate was not justifiable, and the number of hours, you know, 37 and a half hours for just cutting and pasting some pleadings was certainly overreaching. They weren't really doing any extensive drafting. They were just you know, cutting and pasting pleadings from allegations from previous pleadings. And the judge did something pretty extraordinary. He actually visited all eight of the other lawsuits, the sites where the lawsuits had been filed by the same plaintiff's lawyer and by the same plaintiff, and he found that almost all of the ADA barriers that have been identified in these lawsuits had not been changed, and it was really about monetary gain and not eliminating accessibility barriers, and so, which is, you know, something that judges typically don't do. And so the judge found that no attorney's fees were available for this particular plaintiff. But what's important, I think, in this case is the court did not just say, you know, these kinds of cases are terrible. They actually talked about the honorability of bringing ADA cases, and they said, those who take on the honorable cause of representing disabled individuals must recognize that they not only represent their fellow lawyers at the bar, but also the legal giants who paved the way for the passage of crucial civil rights legislation like the ADA. And they go on to say that the conduct of counsel here is indicative of a parasite disguised as a social engineer, and it must stop. And they said if they continue to take on this noble cause, they must do so with the integrity and ethics required of all lawyers, and that the court won't be shy of informing other state bar authorities if they continue with this type of tactics in their litigation. They didn't say they couldn't bring ADA cases. They just said they couldn't bring it in the way they had brought these in the past. So kind of a crazy case to end on, but at this point I'm going to turn it over to Rachel to talk about the next issue.
Thanks, Gary. Another issue that we've seen in recent cases involving hotels and restaurants is the question of is the question of when the clock starts to run on a plaintiff's ADA claim. And this is important because plaintiffs have to file lawsuits within an applicable statute of limitations period. So as a little bit of background, the statute of limitations for ADA claims really varies by state. And the reason for this is that courts usually look to similar state statutes or similar state causes of action to determine what the statute of limitations should be for that particular jurisdiction. So as you'll see, courts have applied different approaches when considering the statute of limitations question. So starting with this first case, Scher versus Marriott, and this is a case that Barry just discussed a little bit earlier, and it was a case brought by a plaintiff in Illinois. And in Illinois, there's a 2-year statute of limitations on ADA claims. As Barry mentioned earlier, in this case, there was a hotel guest who filed a lawsuit seeking injunctive relief under the ADA. What we're going to talk about now is the fact that it was undisputed that this guest filed her ADA lawsuit over 2 years after staying at the Marriott. So as part of its defense, the hotel argued that the guest could not bring her claim because it was barred by Illinois' 2-year statute of limitations period. And the guest responded by arguing that her claim shouldn't be barred because the alleged violation still continued to exist. The Seventh Circuit found that the guest claims were not barred by the statute of limitations because the barriers were continuing in nature. So what does this mean? It means that, at least under the Seventh Circuit case law, if there's an architectural issue that's still in existence at the time of the lawsuit, and as long as the guest is seeking future injunctive relief, then a 2-year statute of limitations or any statute of limitations in the Seventh Circuit is not going to bar somebody's claim, even if the plaintiff herself, as happened here, experienced the actual violation outside of the statute of limitations period. So in this case, it was over 2 years from the date that she filed her lawsuit. Another recent hospitality case that addressed the statute of limitations issue is this case, Hoescher versus Sailorman, Inc., a case from the Middle District of Florida. And this case, the court in this case applied a slightly different analysis. What happened here is that in response to an ADA lawsuit, the restaurant argued that the customer's claims were, again, barred by the statute of limitations because the customer first experienced barriers to the restaurant over 4 years ago. And in Florida, there's a 4-year statute of limitations on ADA claims. But in this case, it was also undisputed that the customer, although she had first experienced the issues 4 years ago, had returned to the restaurant in both 2008 or 2009, which was within the 4-year period, and when she returned, had re-experienced the accessibility barriers. So because of this, the court disagreed with the restaurant and held that each encounter that the plaintiff experienced with the barrier was a new, unique, and distinct injury, regardless of when the plaintiff first encountered the same barrier. We also wanted to note that outside of the hospitality context, other courts have come to different conclusions with respect to statute of limitations. So for instance, in the Frame versus City of Arlington case, which is a case that arose out of the Fifth Circuit, the court held that a plaintiff's claims begin to accrue when a plaintiff knew or should have known about an ADA violation, which again is a completely different standard than we saw both in the Hoescher and the Scher case. And finally, in the Ninth Circuit case, Garcia versus Brockway, which is a case under the Fair Housing Act, again, not the ADA, but just shows that different courts are applying somewhat different standards. In this Ninth Circuit case, the court held that the statute of limitations begins to run at the end of the design and construction phase, at least with respect to Fair Housing Act design and the construction cases. So, this is certainly an interesting legal issue, and it'll be interesting to see how these somewhat varying standards plays out in future decisions. So we couldn't have a webinar about the ADA and hospitality without addressing the Department of Justice's new regulations that have specific implications for the hospitality industry. This next slide is really just a reminder of when businesses such as restaurants and hotels needed to start complying with the 2010 standards for new construction and alterations. So as a kind of a reminder, the new construction and alterations that were built before September 15th, 2010, businesses had to comply with the ADAG, or the ADA accessibility guidelines, which we have listed here as the 1991 standards. Then we've got the small period of time between September 15th and 2010 and March 15th, 2012, where businesses could actually choose whether they wanted to apply the ADAG, the 1991 standards, or the 2010 standards. But as of March 15th, 2012, all new construction and alterations are required to comply with the 2010 standards. So for more information on these rules, you can see, check out the regulations at 28 CFR 36.406. So of particular importance for the hotel industry, the 2010 standards requires hotels, motels, and inns to offer a certain number of guest rooms with mobility features and a certain number of guest rooms with communication features. Now, we're not going to spend a whole lot of time discussing all of these technical requirements, as we really could devote an entire session to this alone, but we at least wanted to highlight the fact that these regulations exist and that hotels should be complying with these requirements. So as a little bit of background, starting with the requirements for guest rooms for mobility features, these can all be found in section 806.2 of the 2010 standards. And this section discusses the requirements that guest rooms with mobility features need to have accessible living areas, accessible dining areas, accessible exterior spaces like patios, terraces, and balconies. These rooms need to have at least one sleeping area with clear floor space on both sides of the bed. They have to have at least one accessible bathroom, an accessible kitchen, and sufficient turning space. So for those interested in learning more about the percentage of guest rooms that need to have these mobility features, you can look at the table 224.2, again, also in the 2010 standards. Likewise, the 2010 standard sets forth requirements for guest rooms to have communication features. And again, this is just a sampling, but under section 806.3, these rooms are required to have alarms accessible to people who are deaf or hard of hearing. They need to have visible notification devices to alert room occupants of incoming calls and door knocks, as well as having telephones that have volume controls and phones that can facilitate the use of a TTY. Table 224.4 explains the number of rooms that need to have these requirements. And so that people with disabilities receive equal access, the 2010 standards require guest rooms with mobility and communication features to be dispersed among the various classes of guest rooms, so that people with disabilities, just like people without disabilities, can choose other features that are important to them, such as the number of beds in a room, the size of the room, the cost of the room, the view, et cetera. And, of course, the DOJ's 2010 regulations include specifications for the very first time for swimming pools, wading pools, and spas. What the standards say is that new construction as of March 15, 2012, needed to comply with these 2010 standards. As most of you probably know or have seen on the news, there's been some there was some discussion about what date existing pools needed to become compliant with these new standards. Initially, the requirement was that all existing pools needed to remove barriers to become compliant as of March 15, 2012, which is the same date as new construction. But after some advocacy by the hospitality industry, the date was extended until January 31, 2013. Again, we can't discuss all the requirements, but here are some very basics for swimming pools. Large pools, which are pools defined as pools with 300 plus linear feet of pool wall, need to have at least two accessible means of entry. One of these accessible means of entry needs to be a fixed pool lift or a sloped entry, and the other can be a fixed pool lift, a sloped entry, but it also could be a transfer wall, transfer system, or pool stairs. Now, DOJ recommends that businesses install two different means of entry to better serve the varying needs of people with disabilities. As you know, because of some people's limitations, they may be able to better access a lift, whereas other people might be better at be able to access a sloped entry. There are different requirements for small pools, which are pools defined as pools with less than 300 feet of linear feet of pool wall. And the requirement for small pools is that they have to have at least one accessible means of entry, either a fixed pool lift or a sloped entry. So for those interested in learning more about the requirements for accessible pools, we encourage you to start by reviewing Section 242.2 of the 2010 standards for the scoping requirements and Section 1009 for the 2010 standards for the technical requirements. But that's not all. The Department of Justice actually has a number of very helpful resource guidances available on this issue. So the slide that we have here includes a list of documents and links to the documents that the DOJ has set forth about the new requirements for swimming pools and spas. DOJ has a document, the ADA 2010 revised requirements. They have a question and answer series about accessibility requirements for existing swimming pools. They have accessible a letter to the American Hotel and Lodging Association, again, specifically regarding these new requirements. And the Department of Justice actually has also done a couple webinars on this topic, and their webinars are archived and available for those interested in learning more. Because of the relatively recent effective date of some of these standards, there hasn't been much litigation on these issues yet, both with respect to the swimming pool issue and the number of accessible rooms and the types of accessible rooms. But there have been a handful of cases filed challenging the inaccessible pools. But so far, we're not aware of any decisions on the merits of these claims. But of course, we anticipate seeing more litigation on this issue in years to come, really and especially in light of the prevalence of pools in the hospitality industry. So it's something that everyone should kind of stay tuned to see how this all plays out in the courts when that happens. Okay, another heavily litigated topic in the world of Title III litigation is against hotels, restaurants, and cruise lines, is that of barrier removal. And just as a reminder, barrier removal is the obligation that existing facilities must engage in under Title III of the ADA. So what the requirement is for readily achievable barrier removal. And readily achievable is defined as easily accomplishable and able to be carried out without much difficulty or expense. And there are a number of factors considered when determining whether barrier removal is readily achievable. These factors include things like the nature and cost of the action, the overall financial resources of the facility or facilities involved in the action, the number of persons employed at such a facility, the effect of expenses and resources, and a number of other factors are considered in the analysis. So let's take a minute to look at how the courts have applied these factors. And starting with some of the non-financial considerations. So Spectre versus Norwegian Cruise Line is a case that Barry spoke about a little bit earlier. This is a case that actually went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And what happened in this case is that passengers with disabilities filed a lawsuit alleging that a cruise line had physical barriers that prevented them from accessing various parts of the ships. Again, before the Supreme Court, the question was whether a cruise line operating a foreign flag in a U.S. port was subject to the ADA. And in this decision, the Supreme Court actually looked at this readily achievable language and considered, does the readily achievable language only have to deal with cost, or does it have to deal with issues other than cost? And the court concluded that that readily achievable impacted more than just cost. And so what the Supreme Court did is it said that because of this readily achievable language, the ADA cruise lines didn't have to do certain things that would bring, didn't have to make certain modifications if doing so would bring the vessel into noncompliance with various international obligations, such as the International Convention for Safety at Life at Sea. And again, the court kind of couched this into this readily achievable analysis and explained that it wouldn't be readily achievable to do something if by doing it, the cruise line would then be in conflict with these international requirements. The court also explained that the ADA's readily achievable language allowed cruise lines to take shipboard safety into consideration, again, as part of this readily achievable analysis. Another case that talked about the non-financial aspects of the readily achievable analysis was this case, Grove versus De La Cruz, which is a case out of California. In this case, a restaurant defended an ADA lawsuit arguing that it was not readily achievable to remove certain architectural barriers because it had no legal right to do so. What happened is that the restaurant was actually the tenant of a property and had a lease agreement with the property owner. And this lease agreement precluded the restaurant from performing architectural modifications. And so in defending this lawsuit, the restaurant again said it wasn't readily achievable because of this lease agreement. But the court said no, that's not gonna work. The court explained that although a landlord and a tenant can allocate compliance obligations under the ADA, it really had no impact on an ADA lawsuit brought by a customer. Regardless of the readily achievable language, it wasn't going to impact it. So as you see, one example of the readily achievable language being used successfully as a defense and one where it was not used as a defense. But as you might have anticipated, most cases about barrier removal do focus on the financial aspects of the request. There's an interesting question in the case law about whether these cases can be resolved on a motion for summary judgment. And the case law on this is pretty mixed. In this case, Siegel versus Ricky's Restaurant and Lounge, which is a case that Barry discussed earlier, the restaurant moved for summary judgment in defense of the ADA case. But really, even though they moved for summary judgment, didn't provide much evidence to support it. All the restaurant said is that the cost of removing barriers, specifically fixing the parking lot, pavement, door, and bathroom, were more than it could afford. But it really provided no additional evidence of this. And not surprisingly, without more, the court found that this was insufficient to support a motion for summary judgment. In the next case, however, Hardy versus Mall Motels, which is another case out of Florida, the court did dispose of this case on cross motions for summary judgment, finding both for the plaintiff on some issues and for the defendant on other issues. In this case, the plaintiff brought a Title III ADA case saying that the hotel needed to remove barriers because it was readily achievable. And in support of the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment, the plaintiff provided an expert report which explained all of the ADA violations and it explained all the cost of estimated cost of compliance. And in addition, what the plaintiff did was it also provided the hotel's tax documents to say to the court, hey, you know, this is how much it costs. And, you know, it might be this amount of money, but look at how much this hotel had spent on other things, other various expenses that were pretty similar in nature, things like painting and building renovations. So the court found that it was able to decide as a matter of law that certain barriers were readily achievable to remove. Specifically, the court found that the hotel needed to install proper signage, it needed to adjust writing desks, it needed to bevel thresholds, it needed to raise electrical outlets in guest rooms, restripe the parking lot, install handrails, and convert a unisex bathroom to an accessible bathroom. But at the same time, the court also found that certain other barriers were not readily achievable to remove. It found that it wasn't readily achievable to create 7 fully accessible guest rooms, including 2 with roll-in showers, and it also found that it was not readily achievable to install handrails on stairs. And again, this was all based solely on the financial considerations. But unlike that Hardy case that we just discussed, this Hoescher versus Sailorman case is actually an interesting example because in this case, the court said that issues of readily achievable barrier removal are rarely decided on motions for summary judgment. In this case, a customer who used a wheelchair brought a Title III lawsuit, again alleging various architectural violations of the ADA at a restaurant. And in response to the restaurant's motion for summary judgment, the customer presented evidence that the restaurant had made at least $250,000 in profit and that the total cost of bringing the facility into compliance was $20,000. And so the court found that the plaintiff successfully established a genuine issue of material fact and so that the case could proceed to trial. And as I mentioned, in addition to that, the court just commented generally that barrier removal is so fact-dependent that it's rarely decided on motions for summary judgment. But again, this is something that we've kind of seen the different courts take a different approach on. The next case, Access for the Disabled versus First Resort, another case out of Florida. This case actually went forward to a bench trial. In this case, in response to a customer's ADA claim, the hotel made a number of modifications, but did not install roll-in showers. So the only issue that went to trial was whether the installation of roll-in showers was readily achievable, and the court found that it was not. As evidence, the court looked to the fact that the hotel was able to show that it could not afford the roll-in showers. The hotel had put forth evidence that it had a negative net income for 7 of the past 8 years, and it also explained that to install the roll-in shower, it would have had to close down 2 rooms due to noise, and that it would have taken the hotel approximately 1 year in gross rentals from one room to recoup this cost. So I think all of these cases reinforce what we already know. Barrier removal is a very fact-intensive inquiry, and both customers and hospitality providers need to root their arguments in the facts to be successful, both at the summary judgment and at the trial stage. We also wanted to alert everyone that the Department of Justice has become involved with these barrier removal issues. We wanted to highlight 2 recent agreements that were relevant to the hospitality industry. The first was a consent decree with the restaurant chain Rosa Mexicana, where the restaurant agreed to remove numerous barriers, including installing automatic sliding doors at entrances, add accessible signage, accessible bathrooms, and create and maintain clear floor space. And the second is a settlement agreement with Mrs. Toll House Restaurant, where the restaurant agreed to install a fully accessible toilet as well as other changes, such as directional signage, widening the doors, replacing entry door hardware, and also install an accessible lower portion of the counter and the bar.
Thanks, Rachel, I'm going to turn it back to Barry. I don't think we have any questions in the chat box, so we're going to keep going, except that we were asked to, when we talk about circuits, try to give an indication of what geographic area that is, and we'll try to do that. Thanks for that comment. I also want to let you know that while Rachel was speaking, I did get an email from DOJ indicating that settlement is now public that we first talked about in the very beginning with respect to the Corral of Westland case involving the woman with the blisters and being excluded, her children with blisters being excluded, and the DOJ did get $50,000 for that family, as well as $10,000 in civil penalty, mandatory training, and changes of policies and stuff. So some more detailed information coming out from DOJ as we speak on that specific case. Next, we're going to move into modifying policies to address issues, and the ADA's regulations make clear that modifications have to be made in policies by entities like restaurants and hotels, and that's a requirement under the ADA. And some common examples that we're going to talk about today are service animals and reservation requirements. So with respect to service animals, people will remember that DOJ revised the definition of service animals a couple years ago to mean that any dog that is individually trained to do work or perform tasks would be considered a service animal. And just a reminder that local laws may have different definitions and broader definitions as far as what is considered a service animal. We also have a link here to our service animal brief that we did if you want more detailed information about the change in the definition and some of the court cases interpreting that definition. But what we want to focus on is how this is interface with the issues of the hospitality industry. And there have been a number of hospitality industry cases involving service animals. 2 on this page, the Davis case and the Johnson case, are ones very new from 2013, and one is one of the first cases back in 1997 involving this issue. The first case, Davis, involved a hotel guest who tried to get access to a hotel with her service animal and was denied access. They had a no pets policy, and the defendant here said that the plaintiff didn't show that the denial was based solely on her disability, and the court said they don't have to show that. All they have to show is the hotel failed to make a reasonable modification to its policy to show an ADA violation. And the Johnson case involved somebody who wanted to take a tour of a brewery that had a no pets policy, and the court said they should modify that no pets policy to allow the person here who was blind using a service animal to take the public tour with his animal. Got a couple of cases where they found in favor of the hospitality provider. The Davis case involved what happens when you have an animal that's not quite trained to be a service animal, is in the process of being trained. And in this particular case, the court found that that since the service animal had not yet been trained and was not yet capable of physically assisting the plaintiff, who had a back impairment and said he needed help with his service animal and balancing, but the puppy, who was only 13 weeks old, wasn't quite up to that task yet, then it wasn't a service animal and therefore was not necessary to allow that service animal to be, or that animal to be, in the restaurant. One thing we did want to note is that some states do have statutes that allow access to service animals who are in training. So the training issue is something that is state specific, and you should check out if that's an issue in your case. And then we have the Chris case involved a woman who went regularly to a restaurant. It was like Cheers, where everybody knew your name and they were friendly. She would go there every day and spent a lot of hours there, breakfast and lunch from 9 to 2:30, and then she got a service animal, and all of a sudden people changed in how they responded to her, and she said this change was a violation of the ADA. They didn't exclude her, but they didn't treat her as nicely as they used to, and the court said, you know, the ADA doesn't really apply here. It's not imposing a civility code, and she claimed she was constructively discharged, that the atmosphere was so negative she couldn't possibly be expected to go back, but in fact she did go back for 10 months, and even though she didn't stay there as long, she still stayed there for several hours at a time, and the court found there was no constructive discharge, no ADA violation. The Department of Justice has been very aggressive on these issues and gotten some great enforcement when service animal and people with disabilities have been excluded from the hospitality industry. And if you look at their agreements, they have a lot of common things that that they negotiate, which is requiring them the covered entity to not exclude or provide unequal treatment to people with disabilities who use service animals, to adopt a service animal policy, to train their employees, have signage indicating that people are welcome with their service animals, and also monetary damages and civil penalties. And we've got links here, we don't have time to go through them today, but four different recent service animal settlements that DOJ has reached. If you want more details, just click on those links and you can get them. And then the other issue as far as changing policies has to do with reservation policies. And always since the ADA has been enacted, places of lodging had an obligation under the ADA to make their reservation systems accessible to guests and prospective guests with disabilities. But recently, DOJ revised their regulations just to clarify what the responsibilities places of lodging have. And those regulations became effective on March 15th of 2012. And as you'll see, the requirements include ensuring that people with disabilities can make reservations for accessible rooms during the same hours and in the same manner as those who don't need accessible rooms, that the reservation systems must identify and describe accessible features in the hotels and guest rooms, that the places of lodging must hold accessible guest rooms open until all guest rooms of that type have been rented, and that they have to guarantee that the specific accessible guest room reserved through its reservation system is held for the reserving customer. And we've got an example of a case that DOJ reached recently with respect to Westgate Resorts. This was reached in 2012 after the new regulations became in place. And it's a comprehensive agreement addressing many accessibility barriers, including reservation policies. If you click on the link, you can see the specific things that address reservation policies on page 10 of that agreement. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Rachel.
Thanks, Barry. So we're going to talk a little bit about communication access in the hospitality context. And as a reminder, Title III requires hotels, restaurants, and cruise lines to ensure effective communication for people with disabilities. In many cases, to ensure effective communication, businesses need to provide appropriate auxiliary aids and services. So there's a few different situations where this has arisen in the hospitality context, the first of which is this question of drive-throughs at fast food restaurants. The The big case on this issue is an older one. It's the Sebunger versus Edwards case, which came from D.C. in 1997. In that case, a customer whose desk visited a McDonald's franchise, and he tried to write his order at the drive-thru window, but he had trouble because the employees wouldn't take his order at first, and they asked him to come inside. After the customer refused to come inside, the McDonald's employees eventually filled the customer's order, but they gave him the wrong change, they gave him the wrong drink, and they snickered at him. So the customer brought a lawsuit under Title III, and the court found that the McDonald's franchise did discriminate against customers who are deaf and hard of hearing. So in response, what it did is it ordered an injunction requiring the specific McDonald's franchise to implement policies and provide training about accommodating people who are deaf and hard of hearing. And although the court limited this injunctive relief to the specific McDonald's franchise, it was a very strongly worded opinion. And what it said is that it hoped that this relief was a wake-up call for the National McDonald's Corporation to institute training and procedures about accommodating people who are deaf and hard of hearing. And since that time, there's been at least one settlement agreement on this topic. Just a couple of years ago, the Department of Justice entered into a settlement agreement with a fast food chain in Pennsylvania after a deaf customer complained that the restaurant refused to take his written order at the drive-thru window. So in that settlement, the restaurant agreed to do a number of things, include place picture menus at the drive-thru window and at interior cash registers to be given to customers. It agreed to place pens and paper at the drive-thru windows, and it also agreed to train its staff on serving customers with disabilities and even take corrective or disciplinary action against employees who failed to comply with this new policy. And the Department of Justice was able to negotiate, or was able to get a $1,000 monetary award for the complainant who had initially filed this complaint with the Department of Justice. So another communication issue that's arisen in the hospitality context is the question of whether places of public accommodation need to provide menus in Braille, large print, or other alternate formats. The general rule is that each public accommodation can decide how to provide effective communication, so long as that their chosen accommodation is actually effective. And the appendix to the Department of Justice's regulations even talks about this particular issue, and it says that restaurants have no obligation to provide Braille menus so long as the restaurant employees will read the menu to a customer with a disability. This concept was recently tested in the Camarillo versus Carroll's Corporation case, which is the Second Circuit, which is the circuit that includes a number of states out in the Northeast, including New York. In this case, the restaurant did not provide large print menus. And on various occasions, a customer with low vision had asked employees to read the menu. And sometimes they did, but usually the employees responded with annoyance or impatience, and sometimes they would only read part of the menu. So the customer filed a claim under the ADA and went all the way up to the Second Circuit, and the Second Circuit found that this was enough to establish an ADA claim. The Second Circuit explained that this was more than a situation of just rudeness or insensitivity, but rather based on the customer's complaints, there was a reasonable inference that the restaurants failed to adopt policies or procedures to train their employees to provide this type of communication. The Department of Justice has also entered into a consent decree on this issue, and that's the consent decree listed on the bottom of the slide with Friendly Ice Cream Corporation. And in that consent decree, Friendly agreed to institute policies to provide menus and alternative formats or to read menus to customers with visual impairments. So you can read more about that agreement by clicking on that link below. The DOJ has demonstrated its concern on the issue of communication access within the hospitality industry as well. In a voluntary agreement that it reached with Westgate Resorts, the hotel agreed to provide all information that it was providing in alternate formats. So, for example, when the hotel provided things like information about fire safety, maximum room rates, telephone and TV information cards, room service menus, and guest service menus, the hotel agreed pursuant to this agreement to provide all of that information in alternate formats for people with disabilities. And the DOJ has also entered into an agreement with NCL Bahamas in the cruise context, again, to make sure that effective communication was being provided in this hospitality context. So in response to the DOJ's action, NCL agreed to provide auxiliary aids and services on all cruises starting or ending in the United States, as well as all U.S. shore excursions, so long as they were purchased directly from this specific cruise line. NCL also agreed to provide information that's typically communicated on its internal TV in a written format and provide all this information. The information included things like shore excursion, safety, and shipboard activities. The next big issue for hotels and restaurants is the question of website accessibility. And of course, because ADA was enacted in 1990, the statute itself is silent on whether websites must be accessible. And the case law on this issue is still developing, and there aren't that many cases specific to the hospitality context, but there are cases that provide really great guidance for the hospitality context, which is what we wanted to quickly go over today. So what the cases have said is that a website that has a nexus to a physical place of public accommodation must be accessible. The rationale for this is that the ADA applies to goods and services of a public accommodation, and the use of the of suggests broader application than if the statute only applied to the goods and services at a public accommodation or in a public accommodation. So based on this case law, hotels and restaurants would have to make their websites accessible, as their websites have a nexus to a physical location. And of course, hotels and restaurants provide valuable information on their websites, such as reservation information and menus and so on. Based on the same rationale, one case in the hospitality context, this Access Now versus Southwest Airlines, found that a website was not a place of public accommodation. In this case, the court explained that Southwest website had no nexus to a place of public accommodation because Southwest online ticket counter had no corresponding geographical location. But we also wanted to highlight the National Association of the Deaf versus Netflix case, which is a relatively recent case. And this is the court in this case held that Title III did apply to Netflix, even though it was a business housed entirely online. We wanted to bring this up because we think that this is going to have some real impact for the hospitality industry, given the number of hospitality and travel websites that are housed exclusively online. So to the extent that these websites are not accessible, we expect this to be an additional area of litigation in the future. But we encourage everyone to stay tuned, because the Department of Justice is expected to issue a notice of proposed rulemaking later this year. And based on this, we'll be able to have additional guidance on how hotels and restaurants, as well as other hospitality providers, what they need to do to comply with the ADA with respect to website access. And with that, I will turn it back to Barry.
Great. Thanks, Rachel. And Rachel, if you just click on the chat box under moderator, there's a few questions that came in on cases that you had raised. I'm going to move forward on the Title I while you take a look at those, just so that we can get through the information. And then if we have time, you can answer those during the presentation, or we can follow up with that individual afterwards. So we're going to now move to Title I issues. We have four issues we're going to focus on. I'm going to focus on qualified and medical examinations and inquiries, and then Rachel will look at reasonable accommodation as well as defenses, infectious and communicable diseases, and direct threat. This is just background on Title I and what it covers. As we mentioned before, hotels, motels, restaurants, and bars, as long as they have 15 or more employees, are covered under the employment provisions of Title I. And of course, you have to show that you're qualified in order to move forward with your ADA case. And the real big issue that comes up in qualified in these cases that we're going to talk about is whether or not the person's function that they're not able to do is essential or not. And the factors here, we list out what factors are important when considering whether a function is essential. And we'll look at a couple of cases that address that issue in the terms of restaurant managers. The first case is a case against Denny's, where the restaurant manager had been terminated after she went underwent an above-knee amputation, and she had returned to work using a wheelchair or a walker to ambulate. And the Denny's argued that the manager wasn't qualified because she couldn't perform the essential functions. She couldn't step in and perform the tasks of the other positions, such as cleaning, cooking, stocking, and lifting. Denny claimed those were essential functions and that it took 25% of her time. But the court said, wait a second, we're not so sure that's correct, and found that the case should move forward to trial because the job description, which is one of the factors that the EEOC says you look at when determining whether a function is essential, the job description only listed supervisory and administrative tasks. It didn't list helping out other employees with their things like cooking and cleaning and stocking and lifting. And also the manager testified that she had spent most of her time not doing those things, but instead interacting with customers, handling paperwork, and instructing other employees. And they also had a vocational counselor come in and observe operations and never saw any managers doing these non-managerial tasks. And therefore, the court found that a jury could find that those tasks were not essential and could be accommodated to other employees. But if you look at a case going the other way, it's the Burnett case against Pizza Hut. And it's sort of a similar set of facts. This person had fibromyalgia, musculoskeletal pain, and inflammatory arthritis. She took leave and wanted to return with some lifting restrictions and non-repetitive motion restrictions, as well as some different scheduling of her hours. And the court, the Pizza Hut said, yeah, you have restrictions, you're not qualified, you're terminated. The manager argued similarly in the Denny's case that she only was supposed to manage and didn't have to do these physical tasks that could be performed by other supervised employees, and so those tasks were non-essential functions and could be accommodated away. But the court here found in favor of Pizza Hut. They felt that Pizza Hut had provided sufficient evidence that that Pizza Hut did have a legitimate business reason for expecting and requiring managers to assist in performing physical labor tasks, such as helping out employees and covering during low volume periods. And they had evidence that all the other restaurant managers were responsible for doing those tasks. Interestingly, in that case, the plaintiff had proposed as an accommodation getting an additional employee hired to perform the physical tasks she couldn't do. And the court said the ADA doesn't require as a reasonable accommodation to reassign essential functions by hiring a new employee or giving those essential functions to a current employee. Another thing that comes up in these kinds of cases is concerns about guest reactions, and we have the Kerr case involving a hotel employee who brought a lawsuit because her supervisor, she claimed, terminated her because of the negative perception of her disability. This employee had cerebral palsy and walked with a noticeable limp, and she submitted sworn supervisor statements about how the supervisor would comment on her ability to work and express concern about what hotel guests would think. The quote in the case says, "It's your health, sweetie. You have no business working two jobs with the leg the way it is. It's just too much for you." A very patronizing comment. And there was another employee that submitted an affidavit saying that having a supervisor who walked with, or having an employee that walked with a limp looked bad to guests. And so the court found that those statements and those allegations were sufficient for the case to move forward to trial. The other issue I was going to focus on is the issue of medical exams and inquiries, and this comes up in the context of the restaurant context because, as you might remember, when the ADA was being passed, there were lots of concerns raised in the food industry about how the ADA would impact the ability to address employees who might have communicable diseases. And as you might remember, this was the height of the AIDS pandemic in the United States. And even though HIV can't be communicated through food, there was still these perceptions that it could. And so the compromise was that the ADA requires the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, to publish annually a list of infectious and communicable diseases through food handling. And so every year the CDC lists that, and actually HIV has never been listed there, but other diseases have, like hepatitis A. And so the EEOC has put out a really helpful document, and we've got the link there on this slide, how to comply with the ADA when you're a restaurant or other food service employer. And it just reviews some of the issues that we're probably all familiar with regarding when you can ask certain questions and have people submit to exams, but puts it in the context of the food industry. So you'll remember that for pre-employment, you can't ask people questions about their disability, including whether they have one of these diseases on this list from the CDC, because you're not allowed to ask these kinds of questions pre-employment, you have to have a conditional job offer. And after you do have this conditional offer, the guidance explains that food service employers may ask questions about diseases transmittable through food, as long as they ask the employers treat all applicants in the same job category and in the same way. And if you rescind a job offer after you've asked these questions and gotten information, you then have to show that the reason you're rescinding that job offer was job-related and consistent with business necessity. And then it reiterates the standard for current employees about that restaurants can ask current employees about medical information, including questions about these communicable diseases. But again, you have to show that if an employer has an objective, that the employer has to show they have an objective factual basis for linking an employee's medical condition to workplace safety or job performance. Then they can ask those kinds of questions. And an employer can also affirmatively require employees to disclose whether they have received a diagnosis related to these communicable diseases, or they have certain symptoms or high-risk conditions that relate to that, and they can require medical clearance if, in fact, that's at issue here. And in a moment, Rachel will talk about this issue in the context of reasonable accommodation. And we have some links here for some resources from the EEOC on medical exams and inquiries, and then you can also check out the specifics with respect to the EEOC guidance we gave you before on food service employers. And with that, I'll turn it to Rachel to talk about reasonable accommodation.
Thanks, Barry. And we do have a number of questions, but I think we're going to continue on with the PowerPoint. And then if we're not able to get all the questions answered, we will certainly answer them offline to those who asked the question. So continuing in the Title I context, of course, discrimination under the ADA includes the failure to provide a reasonable accommodation. As a quick reminder, reasonable accommodation is any modification or adjustment to the work environment that essentially either helps someone do their job or to enjoy the benefits or privileges of their job. And the reasonable accommodation requirement has certain limitations, such as employers don't need to provide an accommodation that would be unreasonable, would cause an undue hardship, or cause a direct threat to the health or safety of others. So a question for everyone to think about is whether it's reasonable for a restaurant employee to have a service animal at work. And interestingly, this is one of the topics that is addressed in the EEOC guidance that Barry was just discussing. And what the EEOC says is that it may be. What the EEOC explains is that a restaurant can't automatically reject an employee's request to use a service animal at work. But instead, like all accommodations, they need to assess it on a case-by-case basis. But the EEOC points out that the FDA Food Code, Section 2403.11, speaks to this issue. And what the Food Code says is that employees can't handle animals inside of a restaurant, but there is an exception for service animals under certain circumstances. These circumstances are that the service animal has to be, it may be permitted in areas not used for food prep, and an employee can handle a service animal so long as after doing so, the employee washes his or her hands and has certain requirements for 20 seconds, has to use soap and water, has to use vigorous friction, and needs to follow by rinsing and drying. But of course, like all employers, restaurants can consider whether a service animal would pose an undue hardship or a direct threat. You know, we don't believe that there's been any litigation on this issue, but it would certainly would be interesting one if cases on this issue were filed. As Barry mentioned earlier, back when the ADA was passed, there is this defense, and what the ADA instructs is that the Secretary for Health and Human Services is going to create this list of infectious and communicable diseases, and they're going to widely distribute it, they're going to publish it, and businesses, including restaurants, can look to this list to decide whether to assign or continue to assign an employee to a food handling job. But what we wanted to really emphasize today is that prior to exclusion, there are certain things that that restaurants should keep in mind. And this, again, is all information that's in the EEOC guidance. So what the EEOC says is that before excluding an employee that has one of the transferable or communicable diseases, they should go through a number of steps. the employer should consider whether the employee is even working in a food handling job, because if not, there's no reason to exclude him or her. Next, the employer should consider whether a reasonable accommodation would eliminate the risk of transmitting the disease, and if so, whether there's any undue burden on the undue hardship of providing that accommodation. And finally, if there isn't an accommodation that wouldn't result in an undue hardship, the question is, well, whether there are any other vacant positions available that don't involve food handling for which an employee is qualified, and if so, that employee should be reassigned as a reasonable accommodation. Again, this is another area that hasn't really been tested in the case law, but the EEOC does provide very helpful guidance, and we encourage all of you to take a look at the link that we have provided on this page about food service providers. And finally, although it's technically a different defense under the ADA, the defense of direct threat is one that also raises similar issues that are important to the hospitality industry. Again, a direct threat is a significant risk of substantial harm to the health or safety of an individual that can't be eliminated or reduced by a reasonable accommodation. So we wanted to share an interesting case that is somewhat akin to a hospitality context, although it actually arose out of a prison. And this is the Henderson versus Thomas case. And in this case, a class of prisoners with HIV brought a class action on behalf of all current and future inmates with HIV, saying that the Alabama Department of Correction actually had a policy in place that restricted inmates with HIV from either participating in kitchen jobs or participating in food service jobs in their work release program. This case was not a Title I employment case, but because it was in the prison context, it was a Title II Section 504 claim. But what the court did is it considered whether there was any sort of risk, and it found that these policies were, quote, obviously irrational. And the court proclaimed that, quote, the science is unanimous. There's no risk of HIV spreading through food. So again, not in the Title I context, but this case is also good guidance, kind of reemphasizing everything that Barry said earlier that about how the hospitality industry should move forward with interacting with employees with HIV. And the EEOC guidance that we keep referencing also emphasizes that HIV is not on the CDC list or in the FDA food code as a disease transmissible through food, and so employees shouldn't be excluded on this basis. And that brings us to our last topic for today, which is disability-based harassment. When an employee brings a claim for harassment under the ADA, the employee has to prove a number of elements. They have to prove that they're qualified, that they're subjected to unlawful harassment, that the harassment was actually based on their disability, and that the harassment was legal harassment, in that it was severe and pervasive to alter a term, condition, or privilege or employment. And there also has to be a reason to impute liability to the employer. Okay, so let's look a little bit at how this is played out in the hotels and restaurant context and case law. The first case we're going to discuss is Navarre versus White Castle Systems. In this case, an employee with ADHD and Tourette's syndrome alleged that he was harassed both verbally and physically on the basis of disability. And the court agreed, at least at the summary judgment stage, that the employee had established a genuine issue of material fact, because the employee presented evidence that he was subjected to physical abuse. He was pushed, shoved, and threatened. His coworker actually threatened to punch him, and that he was subjected to verbal harassment. The employee was able to show that his coworker used words to describe him like, quote, retard and stupid, and asked him if he was dropped on his head. You know, all phrases that were used even after the employee objected to the use of these words and explained that he was a person with a disability and was offended by these words. So at issue in this case was whether this was based on the employee's disability. And in the litigation, White Castle argued that these words weren't intended to be literal, but rather they're just these common words that they're used, and there's no natural association to an actual disability. But at this point, the court did not agree. It found that these words at least were associated with the disability, and that because this employee had experienced these words on a near daily basis for at least 3 months, this was severe and pervasive and amounted to disability-based harassment. Similarly, in EEOC versus Bob Rich, a jury awarded an employee of a Subway franchise who was hard of hearing $165,000 after a trial. what the employee was able to show is that he was harassed based on his disability because a number of employees, including high-level ones like the owner and the training manager, mocked her disability by making comments such as, read my lips, can you hear me now, and you got your ears on. But unlike the White Castle and Subway examples, there have been other cases where certain language was not found to relate to someone's disability. In this Mitchell versus Fowler Foods case, an employee was called words like slow and mentally retarded, but this employee who didn't actually have intellectual disabilities, she had depression, bipolar disorder, and PTSD, the court found that these types of words, even when directed to an employee, to a person with a disability, were insufficient to establish a hostile work environment claim, and the court found for the restaurant in that case. So it looks like we're near the end of our time today, if not at our end of our time. Barry, should we try to do a couple questions?
Sure. There's a couple questions on service animals I can answer real quickly, I think.
Sure.
One is there's a question about can a person be denied the right to volunteer at an organization just because of the use of a service dog? And so that would go to the issue of whether they're covered by the ADA, and I think that's definitely something that would be, if you give me, we can maybe set up an email and you can talk more specifically about the typical type of organization you're talking about and address that. The another question was about whether there has to be some sort of certification of training, and what's clear is that the dog service animals have to be individually trained to perform a task. They don't have to have any kind of training certificate, although certainly people, if they have those, they can present those, but that's not required. And then another question about surcharges at hotels for service animals. Actually, one of the cases that the DOJ brought, USA versus Budget Saver Corporation, they did require a $50 service fee for the service animal, and the court found that that was not permissible. The question is a little bit of a different take on that, talking about whether if it's they just put a debit card hold for the amount and then the surcharge, and then that's later withdrawn once they check out. And I think the fact that you're requiring them to do that for their service animal, I haven't seen any cases on that, but I would think that would be impermissible as well. I think we don't have time to address some of the other questions. I don't know if Rachel, if you have any additional comments on that.
No.
Okay, so why don't we just have some resources listed here, the National Network of ADA Centers, as well as links to the EEOC's website, Job Accommodation Network, and the United States Department of Justice, as well as Equip for Quality. And we also just remind you that if you do want CLE credit, and you're an Illinois attorney, just email me at barryt@equipforequality.org. You can also send me questions you didn't have a chance to submit to me, and then Rachel and I will follow up with you directly on any questions that you have. And a reminder that our next session that is going to be broadcast is going to be the anatomy and myth of the ADA drive-by lawsuit, using that terminology we just talked about. Aaron McCullough from the Southwest ADA Center is going to talk a little bit more extensively about some of the issues we talked about today with respect to Title III access cases. And then Rachel and I will return later in September to talk about litigation under the ADA Amendments Act, 5 years after it's been passed. And just a reminder, you will be receiving a session evaluation, and we always appreciate your feedback. So if you'll take time to complete that online evaluation, we would really appreciate it. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Jessica.
Thank you very much. What an excellent webinar. Tons of content, tons of questions. If your questions did not get answered, you do have contact information for our speakers today to follow up with them, and you are always more than welcome to follow up with your regional ADA center at 800-949-4232. So with that, we'd just like to thank you for joining us. To exit our system, you can click on the red X in the top right corner to close the browser. And have a lovely afternoon. Thank you, everyone.